starts with the spirit. And when the spirit is discontent, I get crazy ideas in my head. And I love this program, and thank you for asking me to come up here. You know, it's an honor for me. It's an honor. Anytime somebody want to hear something, I say. Me and Mike are a little different. He's real serious. Me, I kind of wear my recovery a little loose, you know, because I believe you got to have fun. And if you not have no fun in Alcoholics Anonymous and not having a problem, then maybe you need to go back and drink some more. Because this is about me having fun. Book says we're not a glum lot. You know? I read something that said faith has to work in us and through us every 24 hours a day or we'll perish. And what I came here is to stop drinking. But what I found was God. And I found God because I couldn't stop drinking. And what I think what everybody in this room has in common with the book says is that we can't start drinking and stop. I could always start, but I couldn't stop. Now, I need to let you know that alcohol was my solution. I don't give a shit what you say. Alcohol was my solution. The problem is, once I put it in, I couldn't control the amount that I drank once I started drinking. That's the bottom line. And if that hadn't happened, I'd still be drinking. You know, the guy that comes home and has a rough day at work and all the boss is on his behind and all that stuff is going on. And he said, and she said, how you doing, honey? And he said, man, baby's fixing me a martini, right? And he has a martini and he chills out and plays with the kids and he sit down and eat dinner, says prayers with him, watch TV with his wife, goes to bed, gets ready to go to work. Well, that ain't my experience. If I could just do that, if I could just have one drink and say, hey, I'm cool. I had to come here and find out what I suffer from. Because I thought that alcohol was my problem. The problem is that I can't control it once I start to drink. And then all kind of other things happen. Blackouts and all that other stuff that happen. You know, waking up in a motel room with somebody that looked like E.T. Last night, you know, the alcohol told me she looked like Halle Berry, you know, and I was kind of drunk. Yeah. So I'm not an alcoholic. I go in the bar and, you know, I have three or four different choices, you know, and she was the last one. Right? Because I struck out with the other three. I don't know, y'all didn't ever do no stuff like that. You know, you come in and you say, that one. That one over there, and that one, you know. And all night she's been drinking beer. You come in, I'll sit and buy her a drink. She's drinking Hennessy. You know, people laugh. Y'all ain't never did none of that, huh? No, all right. Girls know. Y'all know. Yeah. That's why I never got high with the women. They would steal my dope. And I couldn't get it up. And they knew it. They knew it. And, you know, that was the trick. So I just got loaded by myself. I got here April the 6th, 1987. And by the grace of a loving and merciful God, I haven't found it necessary to get loaded or drink again. I was 42 when I got here. I'm 65 now. And I'm so grateful to be 65 because I didn't think I was going to live this long. I really didn't. I mean, my lifestyle wasn't conducive to me living this long. It really wasn't, you know. And I take each day I treasure it. When my eyes woke up, and the first thing come out of my mouth every morning is thank you, God. Thank you that I'm still alive. That my heart. And that's good. The reason why I tell you that because I drank a lot of alcohol. I did a lot of drugs. I remember, and I'm a veteran, a Vietnam veteran, and I remember drinking not too far from the VA hospital in Westwood, and getting drunk, falling out on the sidewalk. And they took me to the VA because they found a VA card in my pocket. And they put charcoal in my stomach. I don't know if you ever had that. That's the kind of drink I am. See, I'm an alcoholic, goes into DTs. I don't know if y'all, because DTs will kill you. You think crack can do it, but DTs will kill you when you're shaking like this. And they took me in there and they put charcoal inside my stomach and they put me on a 24-hour watch. I snuck off and went back to Westwood, got drunk again, and had to bring me back to the same place again. The baffling feature of alcohol. You know, and in the doctor's opinion, it talked about, because I didn't get to smoking crack to the end of my alcoholism, and I was looking for a way out because I'm a blackout drinker, and I don't remember what I do, and I don't remember where I've been, I don't know where I park my car at, I don't know none of that stuff. You know, and so a lot of things when I first got sober, it was like a blur. You know, I mean, I couldn't remember what I had did and where I went. You know, and some things I do remember. And I remember going and to a bar. Now I'm the kind of alcoholic that go in a square mile of my house, and I would hit the bars that I'm always familiar with. And that night, my friend met me at another bar and took me someplace else I wasn't familiar with. I got drunk and couldn't drive home, and he drove me home. And I got up that morning, and my wife at that time got ready to go to work and went out there, and the car went out there. She said, "Where's the car?" And I said, "Oh, it broke down." So I had it towed to the mechanic. And all week I had to tell that lie because I didn't know where the car was. And until my friend called me, and my friend that took me over there had went on vacation. So when he came back and he called me and he said, "Hey man, how you doing? I seen your car at the bar." I said, "Hey man, where's it at? Well, hurry up." Yeah. You know, cause my wife was hot as fish grease. You know, fish grease is pretty hot, right? Because she had to get on the bus with the baby, which is 6 months old, take it to the nursery, get back on the bus and go way up on Wilshire Boulevard to go to work, and then have to do the same thing on the way back all week long. And I had to keep lying about that. That's just one of my little escapades. I got introduced to crack cocaine in 1986. And some friends of mine thought they was friends. Let me get honest. I worked in the VA, and I worked as a psychiatric nursing assistant. And if you don't know what that is, that's like we're a babysitter for crazy folks. So what we do is they give them the medication, and we observe them. And then we go tell the doctor, the nurse, "Y'all need to get him some more medication." Two patients turned me on to crack cocaine. Two psychiatric patients. He said, "Man, you ever tried crack?" And I'm always gullible, you know, because I always try anything. Red devils and crosses and psychedelics. But it was always drank alcohol with them. You know, I remember when somebody gave me a little tablet of Purple Haze. And he said, "Well, take half of that." I said, "This ain't for this." I took the whole thing. They hurry up and took me home. I didn't know why, but I went in and I was watching Star Trek, and all of a sudden it just started coming out the screen, the spaceship and stuff. And I said, "Oh, Lord, you know how you say that prayer? Oh, if you get me out of this, Lord, I swear I ain't going to do it again." And then I was outside all night, and I went and got me a big old jug of Red Mountain wine. And I, you know, kind of you put your finger in, and I throw it on my shoulder, and I was drinking under the tree all night. I'm trying to come down. And as soon as I came down, I went and got some more. That's how crazy I am. Anyway, they took me and we went and got a little $20 rock, and we were sitting in the car, and I'm sitting in the back seat, and they're smoking. Now they're professional smokers. I can tell because they were sweating and they were tweaking and all that stuff, and I'm standing and I said, "Damn, you know." And they said, "You gonna smoke yours?" I said, "Yeah." So they put it on there and they gave me one hit and they smoked the rest. He said, "Well, how was it?" I said, "Man, I ain't shit. Give, stop at the liquor store and let me get me a bottle of Hennessy." Shoot, you know, I did that. And so they said, "Well, next week, what we'll do is we'll get an eighth ounce and we'll go by your house and we'll smoke because your old lady be at work and I work PM shift, right?" You know, so they set me down, they put me in the middle, and they had three pipes, and they would pass, and they gave me some clear cut directions. You know how they do when you sponsor? They sponsored me. Turn it to the side, you know, put the flame on that way. Now pull, and that kind of stuff. The bell rang. I thought I had reached the epitome of a high. But like Bill said, man, it was like a boomerang. It came back and just cut me to bits. I'll let you know, I only freebase for 8 months. I don't, and you people that did it for years, I swear I don't see how you did it. You can always tell the speaker when he's getting close to the end of his story, when he starts saying, start talking about freebasing. He's getting to the end. 8 months. I came in here, show up, said that dope fiend prayer, sitting on the curb, 3 o'clock in the morning, with some newspaper and a squeezy board. Something I said I wouldn't do, and I talked about the people that was doing it. You ever do that? You ever say to yourself, if I get as bad as him, I'm quitting. And then I got bad as him and I found somebody else I could point the finger at. You know, 'cause I don't know about your thing, my brain is broke. My brain told me, I done left a three bedroom house, right, with somebody I was living with to go live in the park 'cause she was interfering with my smoking. And my brain told me, say, I was better than the people that were sleeping out there because I had a sleeping bag. And you a Vietnam vet. Bivouacking was just that down my alley. Shit. I'm a soldier. Sleeping outside, no big deal. That's how crazy my brain is. But anyway, I said that to a dopamine pair. I said, God help me. Next day, I went in treatment. I went in an outpatient program. Stayed in there for 11 months. Hated it. They hated therapy. You know, my therapist, he was always on my ass. Because I'm a trickster. Cool, slick, and every inch of the word. Manipulator, liar, cheater, you name it. Because I was raised up in the streets. And if you didn't get it in the streets, you got. So I had to know. See, my heroes wasn't Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and all that. My heroes were them brothers that was driving them big, long, shiny cars, wearing mink coats, with them gangster hats on, with big bankrolls that chokes elephants. That was my heroes, and I wanted to be like them. But I wound up in Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholic Anonymous. You know. If you'd asked me when I was growing up as a kid, say, what do you want to be? The last thing I would say is, I want to be an alcoholic and a crackhead. No, that wasn't in my plan. This wasn't in my plans, right? But I stayed there 11 months, and they kicked me out. But in 11 months, I was going to meetings. I went to a meeting in Compton, California. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a pretty rough part of outside of Los Angeles, and at an AA meeting, and I heard a guy speak. His name was Joe Hawk. And see, I sat around in the rooms for 90 days. And after 90 days, you know, after 29 years of drinking alcohol, you separated me from it for 90 days. And what I became was restless, irritable, and discontent. And what I heard in the fellowship was what it was like. Now, at first, it was kind of amusing. Then after a while, it got kind of old. You know, because I knew how to drink. I knew how to get drunk. I knew every. You know, it's a funny thing about, I had a sponsor who said, well, I don't know if I want to tell you my whole life story. And I said, look at me and tell you something. The bartender at my bar, where I used to go to, he knew all my business. I fifth step with him every night. Because when I get drunk, my tongue get real loose. And I tell him all my business. Tell me when my old lady wouldn't give me none, tell me this, and all of my problems at work and all that. He was like my psychiatrist or something, you know what I mean? Nobody ain't gonna do. See, everybody knew I was a liar and a cheat. He said, hey, go, you got somebody's TV. I steal your shit and help you look for it. See, you show you didn't find it around here. It'd be in my pocket. Right? That's what I do. Anyway, so this guy began to talk about the steps, and he began to talk about it in a way, you know, that I never, in a language I never heard before. And I guess it's the spiritual side of me said, hey, ask him to be your sponsor. And my ego said, nah, you're okay. And next week I went to another meeting, someplace else. Now show you how God worked. I walk in, it's the same guy. Same message. And the guy that I got to sponsor me, he said, look, I'll talk to him and find out what he know, and I'll pass it on to him, on to you. His name was G.W. And I don't know what happened, but after about a month, my sponsor changed. He was all tore up. He was tore up. I was like, what's going on in the first step? And I don't know about you, but the first step is not a comfortable place to be. I don't see how people say, I'm powerless, I'm okay with that. Bullshit. Powerless. See, powerless suck. Powerless is okay when everything going my way. You know, I say, oh, I'm powerless, yeah. let something not go my way. It sucks. You know what I mean? And, we started this process, and he was always a little bit ahead of me. And it's one thing to read the step on the wall, and it's another thing to have a first step experience. And in the first step, I needed to have that experience. And I found out in the first half of the first step what I really suffered from on a mental and a physical level. On a physical level, I found out in the doctor's opinion, you know, that I had this allergy, that I had an allergic reaction to alcohol. And then and how it manifests itself is that I have this phenomenal craving. And it's one thing to be able to read the book, but it's another thing to be able to have the book come alive for you. You know what I mean? Because I didn't read the book, but if I need to see myself in the book. And a lot of things I'm going to tell you is things that I didn't know prior to getting here. You know, because the doctor had a theory that we was allergic to alcohol. I give my sponsors that all the time. We get all the way through almost the inventory, and I go back and I say, what was the doctor's theory? They said, I'm saying, you don't remember? That's like me going to the doctor, and he say, hey, man, you got prostate cancer. Come back next week, and we'll see what we're going to do about it. And I come back next week, and the doctor said, and I said, doctor, what did I have? See, because I know that the disease that I suffer from will kill me, just like anything else, cancer and anybody else. You don't believe me? Everybody, I bet you everybody in the room knows somebody that died from the disease. It's some serious stuff. So why would I forget that they told me? It said my alcoholic life was normal. Was it? Yeah. They told me to take the sentences and the statements and turn them into questions that apply to me, and I had to do that. And Scott talked about being recreate my life. But before that, it says the message that can hold an alcoholic must have death and weight. My thing is that the message is for somebody, but the message ain't for everybody. Because people can find depth in waiting what it was like, what it was like, what it was like, what it was like. I found depth and weight in the solution. It's all about in the doctor's opinion about did other methods fail for you completely? And I'm a firm believer that you need to try everything that you possibly tried prior to getting here. If you don't, your head will come up with a new idea. Let's try this. Let's stand on my head and smoke. I'm serious. My sponsor asked me, what are the methods you tried? Well, I tried giving my money to somebody. Tell them to hold it for me. Don't give it back to me no matter what. And then I would go out and get drunk and I would get loaded off of crack cocaine, and then I would come back and ask for it back. And they would say, Greg, you told me not to give it back to you. And then I would go into dope fiend mode. Y'all don't know what dope fiend mode is? Give me my money or I will kill your ass. My eyes be about this big. Give me my money. So I found out that didn't work. This first step experience. So I decide, get smart. I said, this time what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a list of everything that I needed to do when I get paid. And at the bottom of the list was, I'm going to get me a 20. Right? So when I went to the check cashing place and I slid my check in and slid that cash back, the 20 came to the top of the list. And every time I took a hit, I scratched something off the list. So I knew that didn't work. So I tried to mail the money to myself. Got me a money order, put it in there. And I save a little bit so I could get high and drink. And then when I ran out of money, I couldn't wait to the mailman. He was on the other street. I went over there and said, hey, man, you got a letter for me. I need it right now. He said, well, where you live at? I said, on the next street. He said, I'll be over there in a minute. I said, I need my money now or I will kill your ass. I'm a Vietnam vet. I'm always going to kill somebody. Ain't going to do nothing. Yeah. I couldn't even kill Craig. Craig was killing me. And so I tried that. And I tried all these different things. You know, I tried to buy a lot of it. And all I could think about when I'm doing it is running out. I tried doing some control drinking. And you know, have you tried to do some control drinking? You go all the way to the liquor store, get one damn beer, and you go all the way back home, and you sit down, and you drink it. And you go all the way back to the 7-Eleven, you get another beer. And that's how I did, back and forth, until I got too drunk to go, right? I just went, got me a whole case. And I did the same thing with crack. I buy a nickel at a time. Got $1,000 in my pocket. Done spent $900, I done spent $5 of it, and I got $995 in my pocket. But I'm going back. He said, what you want? A nickel? He said, nickel, man, what's this, man, you've been back here 50 times. Why don't you just get up? I said, give me a nickel. That's me. So that's how I find out that once I put it in my body, I have no control over the amount that I do once I start. See, Mike can tell you, very few of us are both. And I did both. I develop a phenomenal craving with both of them. I don't develop no phenomenal craving with marijuana. Because when I got tired of marijuana, I just quit smoking it. I said, I'm tired of being hungry. I'm tired. I'm tired of these seeds popping, messing up my pants, my silk shirts, and all that stuff. So I just quit. I drive Red Devils, and you know, I said, when I got tired of tearing up cars and running into poles and stuff, I stopped doing that. I just stopped. You know. So there was a lot of things I just stopped doing. And my head said, you can stop doing this too. You know. But I couldn't. And that's the delusion that I suffer from. And then I understand that concept when I said, when I talked about putting it in the physical, what happens to me on the physical level. Then they tell me on page 23 that all that stuff I learned up to page 23 was pointless and academic if I never took the first hit or that first drink. So the real problem centers in my thinking. I said, oh shit, I'm fucked. I'm really screwed now. And I realized that, that every time I got loaded or drunk, I was sober first. And every time I did it, this talked me into it. And I would find, like the book said, 100 different alibis. And some of them was plausible. But in light of everything that happened to me as a result of me doing it, it didn't sound, you know how you do. Let me tell you how my head do. You see, let's go get one. I said, okay. And my head said, well, we just gonna get one. And my body said, okay, that's cool. I'm sober. And I go get one. And I finish that off. I said, oh, my head said, okay, let's go. My body said, no, 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 hell no. We got to have another one. Oh, y'all don't relate to that shit. So I get another one. And I do that on the promise that I'm going to do something else. That I'm going home. Because I told my old lady I was coming home. And I get it. And so after a while, I don't have no control. My mind cannot control my body. My body craves it. And I can't stop my body from craving it. And whatever comes into my head, my body overrides it. So after all the money's gone, and I'm sitting there in comprehensible demoralization, ain't got no money left, ain't got no resources, done sold everything I had, I'm sitting there in my head telling me, you stupid. You dumbass. You did it again. I said, that ain't never happened to y'all, right? So I'm looking at that. And I know that I can't control my thinking. This is my take on this. And a lot of people think that I'll have a mental defense against that first drink. Except for a power greater than me. It says on page 43. Right? And what I see is that I don't have a defense against the thought coming in my head. You know, you just be walking along, driving along in your car, and all of a sudden the thought just come in your head and said, you know, I live in Lancaster, California, it was 115 degrees, and I'm riding down the street, and my head said, man, it'd be nice to have a Budweiser. And for that red moment, I seen it, and I seen the sweat dripping off of it, and it was a long neck. Now, what I don't have a defense against is acting on that thought. And that's where God came in. That's my story. That's where God intervenes. He intervenes. Then the thought that came in that overrided said, let's go and get us a soda pop, and that's it. Let's have some Kool-Aid. We're 23 years sober. You don't think I think about it? Sometimes, every now and then I do. But I don't have a defense against it coming in my head. So I got that, and I know that, and I know that with all my heart and my mind, body and soul, and I know if it ain't but for the grace of God, I do it again. And I continue to do it over and over again. Something's got to stand between me and that next one. And it ain't me. And it ain't my sponsor. It ain't the meetings. My sponsor told me just going to meetings ain't gonna keep you sober. Told me working in the book, doing the steps ain't gonna keep you sober. Being a service ain't gonna keep you sober. And I know what's running through your mind. See? He said, but if you don't do those things, you probably won't get access to a power greater than yourself, which will keep you sober. And the steps are designed to get me access to that power. So, and then I find out my life is unmanageable. And I think it is because I ain't paying my rent and I ain't doing what I'm supposed to do. But my life is unmanageable because I suffer from a spiritual malady, something that's deep down inside of me. This is the news. When God made you, He gave you, He didn't leave nothing out. He equipped you with everything you would ever need. And he put the most important part in here. And you know why he put it in there? Because he knew that would be the last place you'd look. It is. Anything I do, I'm looking out here. Because I'm addicted to ease and comfort. If my life is unmanageable, I'm looking for a different way. And you know, this as a new person in the program, I find something else in it. Because the minute I stop drinking and stop using, I'm looking for a substitute. And immediately, my head tell me I need a relationship. Mm-hmm. If I just had the right girl, shaped just the way I like it, and she sex me just the way I like it, I'd be okay. And I get her, and 3 months later, I can't stand her. See, I said, if I just had this job, that's what I need. I need me a job. I just give me a job, and I put on my best suit, and I go up there, and I tell them all the things that they want to hear, and all of that, and beg for the job. And they hire me. And the first time they ask me to do something out of my job description, I get an attitude. Because I done forgot that I was homeless. Because my ego grasped a hold of that. Says, I need that to fix me. And the job don't fix me. And I think, and I like validation. No, y'all don't like none of that. I like validation. I like recognition. So I go down there to the car lot and buy me something I can't afford. My check is $800 and my car note is $779. Well, you know, and I ain't thinking about that, and I'm signing the contract. All I can think about, what I'm going to do is roll to the meeting and park it right up front. See? And when my homies come out and they say, damn, you done came up. I said, yeah, try to act real with a lot of humility. Yes, yes, I did. You know, I don't want to be all prideful and everything. So, yeah, brother, that's right. I don't know. Real humble. And about 2 or 3 months of them, I had car notes, and they ain't fixing me no more. And they described me on page 52. I have a problem with personal relationships. When I'm in a relationship, I'm the only one in it. Because I want to control what you wear, what you look like. You ain't acting this way, you're acting that way. See? I don't trust men. Two things I don't trust men with when I was new. My money and around my woman. So I got a problem in personal relationships. I'm full of fear. Can't control my emotional nature. You know, one day I'm up like this, next day I'm down like that. You know. Only thing that's missing on page 52 is my picture. So I get so they told me that once the spiritual malady is overcome, I'll straighten out mentally and physically. And I believe that with all my heart. You know, the first step is the foundation for me with the program. You didn't get that, you ain't got nothing. And I'll tell you one thing, this is just my opinion. You can do whatever you want to with it. And very seldom I give out my opinion. When people relapse, they relapse because they ain't through. Real simple. You can talk about, oh, the old lady did this, oh, the job was that, and oh, I was depressed. That's a bunch of BS. You just wasn't through. And you'll know when you're through. Trust me. You know, I don't care what happens in my life. I ain't got no excuse. I share this with you. You know, life in sobriety ain't always a bed, but you better get your foundation. It ain't always a bed of roses. I had some, and I talked to Scott today, and I said I had some self, I had some things that happened to me that wasn't a self-imposed crisis, except for one. I got a divorce from my wife. That was in 2004. In 2006, I come out the house, an apartment building I'm living in, looked, and my car is sitting on box crates. Somebody took all my chrome wheels off the car. I said, okay. Next thing that happened, my apartment building catch on fire. I'm upstairs working with a newcomer, the apartment building catch on fire. I'm telling everybody to get out. I'm all across the street, fire department, all the place. I'm standing there watching it burn up. All my stuff gone, TV, new furniture, whole nine yards. Everything that I was leaning on that I thought that made me who I am, God allowed to take it right out of my life. This is the miracle, ladies and gentlemen. Not once did I think about going to the liquor store, the dope house. What I thought about, I said, okay, God, what are we going to do now? I don't know why it's happening. What are we going to do? My friend called me, my sponsee. He said, man, you know, I'll come down and get you right now. I said, I'm cool. I went to a meeting. Because my sponsor told me your dependence and your reliance is always upon God, not upon the group, not upon your friends, it's upon God. And I had to learn that lesson. You know how I learned that? I had a home group that I started, and I've been with that group for 20 years, me and Mike. We started it. I went there and I shared that night that the fire broke out and a burning desire. And two people, and we have 100 people in our group, came up and offered to help. And it showed me, you better depend on God. Two. And I remember the time they went around passing the basket for other people and they had relapsed and helping them get into sober living and all that stuff. Nothing. And I walked out the meeting and I said, okay, God, I don't know what I'm going to do now. I'm homeless. Phone rang. The last person in the world that I thought, she said, call me, was my ex-wife. She says, is that your apartment building that's burning down in Long Beach? I said, yeah, it is. He said, what you going to do? I said, I don't know. She said, bring your ass over here. And I owed her amends. And when I got a chance to make that amends, and I stayed with her 18 months, and it was a living amends. I'm just telling you this. I'm telling you how God worked in my life. And I said, okay, I got to go. I wanted to get married again, but she said, no, she wasn't having it. And that's okay with me. I was. But I said, well, you ain't. I'm moving out. Cause everything in this house belonged to you, the furniture, everything. You ain't nothing in here belonged to me but my clothes. I don't know where I'm going, what I'm going to do. I've got boxes, packed up my stuff, put it in the garage. Somebody called me from a Vietnam vet group, say, man, I heard your apartment building burned down. He said, you need a place to stay. I said, yeah. He said, well, we got a senior citizen place here that, for low-income people that you can move in. So I said, I got to put on the waiting list. He said, I'm going to put you at the top. I know the manager. And I went right to the top of the waiting list. I moved in there. Telling you what God's doing. And I still ain't get loaded. I move in there, I stay in there 6 months, and I went in prayer, and God said, go online and apply for a house. And I argued with him about that. I said, well, how I'm going to get a house? My FICO score was 519. I'm a high risk. He said, do it. I'm a vet. I got a GI Bill. So I go online, I fill out the application. Next day they call me and said, Mr. Suber, we got your application, but we can't help you. I said, okay. That night I got on my knees. I said, okay, God, I did the footwork. I ain't in the result business. That's your line. I did what you told me to do. Next day they call me back. Said, Mr. Suber, we got a special department that handles cases like yours. Said, we're going to give you $250,000 to go look for your house. Next thing, they say to move to Lancaster. I said, what the hell am I going to move to Lancaster? 60-something miles away? I don't know. Like, buddy, up there, but my sponsee said, move to Lancaster. And I move up there. My sponsee, his wife, is a real estate agent. I looked at 15 houses. The last house I looked at, because I was finna go back home, and I walked in the house, and I said, immediately, this is mine. And I've been there ever since. In that house. Yeah, I got it at a 6.5 interest rate, stayed there a year, went back, got it refinanced, dropped it down to 5.5. I'm telling Scott today, I went, just went back and got it refinanced again, dropped it down to 4.3. My house note is $933 a month. I know people pay more than that for rent. The point I'm trying to make is that you don't know what God... See, if I had still been in Long Beach, I never would have got that house. Certain circumstances had to happen in order for me to be able to get where God wanted me to be. And I ain't moved to Lancaster just for a house to get a because I bought another car. I bought a Chrysler 300 Hemi. Every time I drive it, I say, lack of power is not my dilemma. That car is fast. I was telling Scott about that today. I love that car. God said, I'll give you the car so you can give a newcomer a ride home. Because he ain't impressed. You get ready to meet your maker, he ain't going to say, well, man, you know, I had a Chrysler 300. God's going to say, I don't care nothing about that. Who'd you give a ride to? You know? Well, I had a nice house. God would say, who you let stay with you? Did you let somebody stay with you? Because I know that I have to use the gifts that God gives me to help another human being. He didn't give it to me. And the reason why I'm in Lancaster, because God knew there was some people up there that I needed to sponsor. And that's why I'm there. See, that's why I know. The people that I'm working with now is people that I'm supposed to work with up there in Lancaster. And I work with women. I don't sleep with them. I sleep with other women, though. I'm gonna be honest with God, truth with you. I'll tell you, women take directions real good. It's the men that don't. Women, you tell them, you give them something to do, they do it. Bam, it's done. They don't mess around. With men, is the ego. Every time one of them get to the fourth step, they, you know, they come over, they're enthusiastic, they mark and all that, they learn this and that, question mark that and all that, they get the inventory and don't see them no more. That's my experience. And I know inventory is not easy to look at. But it's all about me looking at me. Why can't I look at me? That's all it's about, me looking at me. And the more I know about me, the more I learn about God. And I do inventory to face and be rid of the things that's blocking me from this power that I need to do. You know, if you want to know how to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, work steps 4 through 9. Because them steps are totally against my will. It's against my will to do a fearless and moral inventory of myself. Because I'm an immoral person. It's against my will to do that. And then when I put the pen into the paper, I'll tell you what I did with my first piece of work. And I did the first 3 columns, which is easy because it's about pointing the fingers. That's the easy part. And anybody that gets stuck in the first 3 columns, you really don't want to do no shit. Because that's the easy part. Who I'm resentful at, why I'm resentful, and how you messed over me. And it always comes in the 7 areas of my life, the 7 areas of self. But then when you flip that over and see where I'm selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid, oh, hell no. So, you know, doing a 5th step, admitting to God, admitting to myself and another human being the exact natures of my wrong, that's against my will. My mama caught my hand in the cookie jar. I told her I was just counting the cookies. You know? My mother just played a little trick on you. You know how to tell you, say, if you'd have told me the truth, I wouldn't be beating your ass. Right? So I tell her the truth, She beat my ass anyway. So I said, well, shoot, I might as well laugh. I take my chances, 50-50. I ain't trusting you. You told me there was a Santa Claus. You told me there was the Easter Bunny. You lied. They did. I found the toys in the closet. I mean, I was really disillusioned. You know, I mean, you just don't know what the kind of effect that had on me. I said, man, why would y'all tell me that? And it ain't true. So when I raised my kids, I said, hell no. It ain't come from no Santa Claus. It come from daddy. I'm telling you right now. And she said, don't tell him that. I said, man, forget that. You know, I didn't know what a character defect was until I got to the program. And I know my character defect set up my shortcomings. And I didn't know what a shortcoming. Shortcoming, in case you don't know, is to say, I say I'm going to do something, but I don't follow through. You know, I'm going to go to school, but I don't go register. Well, I'm going to go to school, I go register, but I don't go. I start something, but I never finished. Made a list of all the people that I'd harm and be willing to make amends to them all. I hate that last word in that sentence. All. I had a person that I knew that had the same experience that I had. Somebody, Mike had sponsored. I had that same experience in amends. And I made all my little amends and stuff, and I got to that thing with Bank of America, you know, because in the 80s you could put the blank envelopes in there and get money out. So I embezzled Bank of America about $1,900. Lawrence had the same experience. And my sponsor said, when are you going to make that amends to Bank of America? I said, don't you think you're carrying that AA shit too far? You say, well, you can balk if you want to. Chances are you may get loaded. So he told me to write him a letter. Don't put the return address on the outside. Put it on the inside and your phone number. And I wrote him a letter. A week later, somebody called me. I said, Mr. Suber, this is so-and-so from Bank of America. I got your letter and would like to know if you would like to come in and talk to us about it. Now my head said, no, not really. But I said, yeah, I'll come talk to you. First thing my head told me, you go in jail. See? But I prayed. Got on the bus. Got off the bus looking for the police. Ain't seen nobody. Walk in there. There's 40 people in there. I asked the reception for this. Asked the receptionist for this guy. Right, and she called him up there, and he come up to me, and he take me back to his desk, and he sat down, and he said, "I heard you was a friend of Bill's." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Me too." And the point I'm making is that out of all them people in that office, that letter had to go to him. That's how God worked. He said, "Mr. Super, said you pay. How would you like to pay this off?" He said, when you finish, we'll give you a free checking account. Right. So I never know how the men's going to turn out. Sometimes I thought the easiest one became the hardest one, and the hardest one became the easiest one. I made amends to Macy's, and they offered me a job. They said, anybody, they offered me a job in security. So anybody can steal our stuff and get out of here, we need to have him in here with us. Right? Yeah. It's amazing. It's a wonderful program. It's beyond my wildest damn dreams. You just don't know. He knows. 25 years. And the miracle thing I heard you say is that you lost something that was really dear to your heart, but you didn't go to the liquor store. Ain't God good? That's what I'm talking about. and we walk through stuff in this program. That no matter what stuffs. And just walk through it. And it ain't always good. And it ain't always great. And it's always painful. But out, coming out of the other side, I become a better person. And I'm a better person today than I was before. And I know one thing. I may not be the man that I want to be, but I damn sure ain't the man I was. And if you got one day in this program, you blessed. And there's a part of my favorite part of the book that says, despite all we can say, some of us are not going to believe in that class. But every form of experimentation and self-deception and experimentation, you'll try to prove yourself exception to the rule. And what that means, it means that you'll try to find a middle-of-the-road solution. You'll try to half-measure it. Expect to get a full measure. See, I said that means to me is that, oh yeah, you guys have to do that, but we don't. I don't. See, because I'm different from you. You know, that reminds me of Fred. And Fred said, yeah, I got some of the symptoms, and I've been through with you guys, but you know, I haven't went as far as you guys did. Thanks for the information. And he got drunk. You know, I'm serious about this program, and it, you know, I have fun, but when it comes to my recovery, I'm serious, and I don't put nothing before my recovery, my woman, my children, nobody, and I don't care who you are. It's the most important thing I have in my whole life, and without that, I'm dead. I have a relationship with God today is just incredible. Incredible. I'm going to say this. I got engaged about a month ago. And I didn't want to get in debt and buy the ring, but I did. And we was at the store. Then I got on my knees and I asked her to marry me. And the lady at the store took a picture of me on my knees with her phone. Now it's all over Facebook. And the funny thing about that, because see, and me and Mike talked about this, and you know, I have this idea of that ideal woman that I want to have in my life, what she looks like, and what she's gonna be, and how she walk, and she's good in the bed, and all that other stuff, and everything. And you know, and when you ask God for, when I ask God for things, He don't never give it to me exactly the way I want it. Cause I want with no problems, no drama, no none of that. That's what I want. But God gives me people because a relationship helps me work on me. If you're in a relationship, I guarantee you it's going to make you work on yourself. Because every time you, because my sponsor says, if the world and the people have to change for me to get better, I'm screwed. Because that ain't going to happen. So when I'm looking for her to change so I can be okay, I'm screwed. You know what I mean? So, I got a beautiful woman. Sexy, good in the bed, you know, all that stuff. 16 years sober, work a program, accreditation chair for South Central, Long Beach, and sponsees and working with sponsees, but she's disabled. She's got a bad back. And she got a 16-year-old kid, right? And the kid just got pregnant. So, you know, I kind of throw a monkey wrench in my plans, you know. You know, because I'm retired. I ain't got no, my kids are all grown, they gone. But it don't come to me the way I want it. When I prayed about it, and God said, well, you asked me for a beautiful woman, I gave it to you. You asked me for some woman that work a good program, I gave it to you. You asked me a woman that was good in the bed, I gave it to you. What's the damn problem? And if you give me the perfect woman, I ain't got nothing to work on. And that's where I see it. So I got something to work on. With that. you know, friendships and stuff like that is an opportunity for me for you to work on me. It's always opportunity for me to work on me. Every day. Every day I have to work on me. Uncover, discover, and discard. I do 10 on a daily basis. I call somebody and read the 11th step. And why I read my nightly review to him? Because if I don't, a self-appraisal is insufficient. Because if I read it and don't read it to you, I'm going to let myself off the hook. Because I'm the judge, I'm the jury, I'm the DA, and I'm always going to find myself not guilty. But when I read it to somebody else, they said, no, nah, Greg, that's a bunch of BS. You know, so I read it to somebody else, and I get clear. First word in the 10th step says continue. Continue what? Continue what I did in 4 through 9. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When it crop up at once, I'm going to ask God to remove it. See, I did something in the 3rd step and I made a decision and I followed through with some action in 10. I don't know if y'all got that. Because I can be hungry and want some breakfast, but if I don't get up out of bed and cook it or go to Denny's or IHOP, I didn't eat. So it requires me to make a decision, but my decision must be followed with some action. And I follow that action in 10 and it gives me some clear directions. Pause. When I'm doubtful, irritated, ask for the right thought, ask for the right action. It's telling me constantly, turn to God. Turn to God. You know, and that's what I do. And most of the time, I'm happy, joyous, and free. You know, I've learned how to let people be whoever they are, allow you to grow who you are. And I used to tell people all the time when I speak, I don't give a shit whether you work a damn step or not. I don't care whether you don't go to no meetings. And I know that sounds kind of insincere. You know why? Because that ain't none of my business. My business is to carry the message. I am the messenger. I am not the savior. And I tell my sponsees all the time, don't be putting me on no pedestal because I may screw up and then you'll be pissed off. You need to rely on God. God is the only thing you rely on. Continuously, right? Seek God. You know, and I was taught that at an early age. I used to call my sponsor. I'm going to say this, you know. I used to call my sponsor and I'd be all angry and pissed off and shit didn't happen. I'd be... And he just let me go on and talk. Until you know how you talk and then you finally run out of gas. Because, see, I done called everybody in the program that I know would agree with me before I called my sponsor. And I just go, you know, and so-and-so said this. And he just listened and then, and I ran out of gas. And he said, are you through? I said, yeah. He said, I said, you son of a gun. Joe used to do that shit. And I called him back. He said, didn't I tell you to pray first before you call me? So now I learn how to pray. And by the time I get out of prayer and I get on the phone, I'm calm. And I can talk about it. And I can listen. And I can hear. You know, just simple stuff like that. You know. But thank you for allowing me to come out here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And my only hope is that something I said... here, help somebody. You know, that was the whole reason of getting on that plane and riding for 4 hours to get here to do this. Me and my dog, man, we go everywhere. Chicago, World Convention, London. I'm going over there. 2012, I'm going over there. In case y'all don't know, in 2011, South Central District of Cocaine Anonymous is having their convention. Now, to make it unique, we having it on the Queen Mary. It's going to be the bomb. It's a bomb. Because they remodeled the whole ship. all the rooms are different. They remodeled the rooms and everything, and it sits right there, and you can look out over the ocean and everything. It's gonna be cool. So hope I can see y'all there. Thank you for allowing me to be a servant.